entertain such a question, to assume there's any choice in the matter, but there is. We all have a psychological tendency to view our own experience as standard, to see our community as the people, to believe, perhaps subconsciously, that we are the chosen ones, God is on our side, and our team deserves to win. To see the present in the most flattering light, we paint the past in blood-red hues of suffering and terror. Hobbes has been scratching this persistent psychological itch for several centuries now. It is a common mistake to assume that evolution is a process of improvement, that evolving organisms are progressing towards some final perfected state, but they, and we, are not. An evolving society or organism simply adapts over the generations to changing conditions. While these modifications may be immediately beneficial, they are not really improvements because external conditions never stop shifting. This error underlies the assumption that here and now is obviously better than there and then. 3.5 centuries later, scientists still quote Hobbes, telling us how lucky we are to live after the rise of the state, to have avoided the universal suffering of our barbaric past. It's deeply comforting to think we're the lucky ones, but let's ask the forbidden question. How lucky are we, really? Ancient poverty or assumed affluence? Prehistoric humans did not habitually store food, but this doesn't mean they lived in chronic hunger. Studies of prehistoric human bones and teeth show ancient human life was marked by episodic fasts and feasts, but prolonged periods of starvation were rare. How do we know our ancestors weren't living at the brink of starvation? When children and adolescents don't get adequate nutrition for as little as a week, growth slows in the long bones in their arms and legs. When their nutritional intake recovers and the bones begin to grow again, the density of the new bone growth differs from before the interruption. X-rays reveal these telltale lines in ancient bones, known as Harris lines. Periods of more prolonged malnutrition leave signs on the teeth known as hypoplasias, discolored bands and small pits in the enamel surface, which can still be seen many centuries later in fossilized remains. Archaeologists find fewer Harris lines and dental hypoplasias in the remains of prehistoric hunter-gatherer populations than they do in the skeletons of settled populations who lived in villages dependent on cultivation for their food supply. Being highly mobile, hunter-gatherers were unlikely to suffer from prolonged starvation since, in most cases, they could simply move to areas where conditions were better. Approximately 800 skeletons from the Dixon Mounds in the lower Illinois Valley have been analyzed. They reveal a clear picture of the health changes that accompanied the shift from foraging to corn farming around 1200 AD. Archaeologist George Armolagos and his colleagues reported that the farmers' remains show a 50% increase in chronic malnutrition and 3 times the incidence of infectious diseases indicated by bone lesions compared with the foragers who preceded them. Furthermore, they found evidence of increased infant mortality, delayed skeletal growth in adults, and a 4-fold increase in parotid hyperostosis, indicating iron deficiency anemia, in more than half the population. Many have noted the strangely cavalier approach to food among foragers who have nothing in the freezer. French Jesuit missionary Paul Lejeune, who spent some 6 months among the Montagnais in present-day Quebec, was exasperated by the natives' generosity. "If my host took 2, 3, or 4 beavers," wrote Lejeune, "whether it was day or night, they had a feast for all neighboring savages. And if those people had captured something, they had one also at the same time. So that on emerging from one feast, you went to another, and sometimes even to a third and a fourth." When Lejeune tried to explain the advantages of saving some of their food, "they laughed at me. Tomorrow," they said, "we shall make another feast with what we shall capture." Israeli anthropologist Nurit Bird-David explains, "just as Westerners' behavior is understandable in relation to their assumption of shortage, so hunter-gatherers' behavior is understandable in relation to their assumptions of affluence. Moreover, just as we analyze, even predict, Westerners' behavior by presuming that they behave as if they did not have enough, so we can analyze, even predict, hunter-gatherers' behavior by presuming that they behave as if they had it made. While farmers toil to grow rice, potatoes, wheat, or corn, a forager's diet is characterized by a variety of nutritious plants and critters. But how much work is foraging? Is it an efficient way to get a meal? Archaeologist David Mattson investigated the energy efficiency of foraging for Mormon crickets, Anabra simplex, which had been on the menu of the local native people in present-day Utah. His group collected crickets at a rate of about 18 crunchy pounds per hour. At that rate, Mattson calculated that in just an hour's work, a forager could collect the caloric equivalent of 87 chili dogs, 49 slices of pizza, or 43 Big Macs, without all the heart-clogging fats and additives. Before you scoff at the culinary appeal of Mormon crickets, give some thought to the frightening reality lurking within a typical chili dog. Another study found that the Kumsan, in the Kalahari Desert, mind you, had an average daily intake in a good month of 2,140 calories and 93 grams of protein. Marvin Harris puts it simply, Stone Age populations lived healthier lives than did most of the people who came immediately after them. And maybe healthier than people who came long after them, too. The castles and museums of Europe are full of suits of armor too small to fit any but the most diminutive of modern men. While our medieval ancestors were shrimpy by modern standards, archaeologist Timothy Taylor believes that the human ancestors who first controlled fire, about 1.4 million years ago, were taller than the average person today. Skeletons dug up in Greece and Turkey show that pre-agricultural men in those areas were about 5'9" on average, with women being about 5'5". But with the adoption of agriculture, average height plummeted. Modern Greeks and Turks still aren't as tall on average as their ancient ancestors. Throughout the world, the shift to agriculture accompanied a dramatic drop in the quality of most people's diets and overall health. Describing what he terms the worst mistake in human history, Jared Diamond writes, "Hunter-gatherers practiced the most successful and longest-lasting lifestyle in human history. In contrast," he concludes, "we're still struggling with the mess into which agriculture has tumbled us, and it's unclear whether we can solve it." On Paleolithic politics. Prehistoric life involved a lot of napping. In his provocative essay, The Original Affluent Society, Solins notes that among foraging people, the food quest is so successful that half the time the people do not seem to know what to do with themselves. Even Australian Aborigines living in apparently unforgiving and empty country had no trouble finding enough to eat, as well as sleeping about 3 hours per afternoon in addition to a full night's rest. Richard Lee's research with Kumsan Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert in Botswana indicates that they spend only about 15 hours per week getting food. A woman gathers on one day enough food to feed her family for 3 days, and spends the rest of her time resting in camp, doing embroidery, visiting other camps, or entertaining visitors from other camps. For each day at home, kitchen routines such as cooking, nutcracking, collecting firewood, and fetching water occupy 1 to 3 hours of her time. This rhythm of steady work and steady leisure is maintained throughout the year. A day or two of light work followed by a day or two off. How's that sound? Because food is found in the surrounding environment, no one can control another's access to life's necessities in hunter-gatherer society. Harris explains that in this context. Egalitarianism is firmly rooted in the openness of resources, the simplicity of the tools of production, the lack of non-transportable property, and the labile structure of the band. When you can't block people's access to food and shelter, and you can't stop them from leaving, how can you control them? The ubiquitous political egalitarianism of foraging people is rooted in this simple reality. Having no coercive power, leaders are simply those who are followed, individuals who have earned the respect of their companions. Such leaders do not, cannot, demand anyone's obedience. This insight is not breaking news. In his Lectures on Jurisprudence, which was published posthumously in 1896, Adam Smith wrote, "In a nation of hunters, there is properly no government at all. They have agreed among themselves to keep together for their mutual safety, but they have no authority over one another." It's not surprising that conservative evolutionary psychologists have found foragers' insistence on sharing to be one of their most difficult nuts to crack. Given the iconic status of Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, and the popularized status quo protective notion of the all-against-all struggle for survival, the quest to explain why foraging people are so maddeningly generous to one another has occupied dozens of authors. In The Origins of Virtue, science writer Matt Ridley summarizes the inherent contradiction they face. "Our minds have been built by selfish genes, but they have been built to be social, trustworthy, and cooperative. One must walk a tightrope to insist that selfishness is, and has always been, the principal engine of human evolution, even in the face of copious data demonstrating that human social organization was founded upon an impulse for sharing for many millennia." Of course, this conflict would evaporate if proponents of the always selfish theory of human nature accepted contextual limits to their argument. In other words, in a zero-sum context, like that of modern capitalist societies where we live among strangers, it makes sense on some levels for individuals to look out for themselves. But in other contexts, human behavior is characterized by an equal instinct toward generosity and justice. Even if many of his followers prefer to ignore the subtleties of his arguments, Dawkins himself appreciates them fully, writing, "Much of animal nature is indeed altruistic, cooperative, and even attended by benevolent subjective emotions. Altruism at the level of the individual organism can be a means by which the underlying genes maximize their self-interest." Despite famously inventing the concept of the selfish gene, Dawkins sees group cooperation as a way to advance an individual's agenda, thereby advancing each individual's genetic interests. Why, then, are so many of his admirers unwilling to entertain the notion that cooperation among human beings and other animals may be every bit as natural and effective as short-sighted selfishness? Non-human primates offer intriguing evidence of the soft power of peace, and not just horny bonobos either. Franz de Waal and Janice Johanowicz devised an experiment to see what would happen when two different macaque species were placed together for 5 months. Rhesus monkeys, Macaca mulatta, are aggressive and violent, while stumptails, Macaca arctoides, are known for their more chilled-out approach to life. The stumptails, for example, make up after conflict by gripping each other's hips, whereas reconciliations are rarely witnessed among rhesus monkeys. Once the two species were placed together, however, the scientists saw that the more peaceful, conciliatory behavior of the stumptails dominated the more aggressive rhesus attitudes. Gradually, the rhesus monkeys relaxed. As de Waal recounts, juveniles of the two species played together, groomed together, and slept in large mixed huddles. Most importantly, the rhesus monkeys developed peacemaking skills on a par with those of their more tolerant groupmates. Even when the experiment concluded and the two species were once again housed only with their own kind, the rhesus monkeys were still 3 times more likely to reconcile after conflict and groom their rivals. A fluke? Neuroscientist primatologist Robert Sapolsky has spent decades observing a group of baboons in Kenya, starting when he was a student in 1978. In the mid-1980s, a significant proportion of adult males in the group abruptly died of tuberculosis they'd picked up from infected food in a dump outside a tourist hotel. But the prized, albeit infected, dump food had been eaten only by the most belligerent baboons who had driven away less aggressive males, females, or juveniles. Justice! With all the hard-ass males gone, the laid-back survivors were in charge. The defenseless troop was a treasure ready-made for pirates. A whole troop of females, sub-adults, and easily cowed males, just waiting for some neighboring tough guys to waltz in and start raping and pillaging. Because male baboons leave their natal troop at adolescence, within a decade of the dump cataclysm, none of the original atypically mellow males were still around. But, as Sapolsky reports, the troop's unique culture was being adopted by new males joining the troop. In 2004, Sapolsky reported that two decades after the tuberculosis tragedy, the troop still showed higher-than-normal rates of males grooming and affiliating with females, an unusually relaxed dominance hierarchy, and physiological evidence of lower-than-normal anxiety levels among the normally stressed-out, low-ranking males. Even more recently, Sapolsky told us that as of his most recent visit in the summer of 2007, the troop's unique culture appeared to be intact. In Hierarchy in the Forest, primatologist Christopher Boehm argues that egalitarianism is an eminently rational, even hierarchical political system, writing, "Individuals who otherwise would be subordinated are clever enough to form a large and united political coalition, and they do so for the express purpose of keeping the strong from dominating the weak." According to Boehm, foragers are downright feline in refusing to follow orders, writing, "Nomadic foragers are universally, and all but obsessively, concerned with being free of the authority of others." Prehistory must have been a frustrating time for megalomaniacs. "An individual endowed with the passion for control," writes psychologist Eric Fromm, "would have been a social failure and without influence." What if, thanks to the combined efforts of very low population density, a highly omnivorous digestive system, our uniquely elevated social intelligence, institutionalized sharing of food, casually promiscuous sexuality leading to generalized childcare and group defense, human prehistory was in fact a time of relative peace and prosperity? If not a golden age, then at least a silver age, Bronze Age being taken. Without falling into dreamy visions of paradise, can we, dare we, consider the possibility that our ancestors lived in a world where, for most people, on most days, there was enough for everyone? By now, everyone knows there's no free lunch. But what would it mean if our species evolved in a world where every lunch was free? How would our appreciation of prehistory, and consequently of ourselves, change if we saw that our journey began in leisure and plenty, only veering into misery, scarcity, and ruthless competition 100 centuries ago? Difficult as it may be for some to accept, skeletal evidence clearly shows that our ancestors didn't experience widespread chronic scarcity until the advent of agriculture. Chronic food shortages and scarcity-based economies are artifacts of social systems that arose with farming. In his introduction to Limited Wants, Unlimited Means, Gowdy points to the central irony. Hunter-gatherers spent their abundant leisure time eating, drinking, playing, socializing, in short, doing the very things we associate with affluence. Despite no solid evidence to support it, the public hears little to dispute this apocalyptic vision of prehistory. The sense of human nature intrinsic to Western economic theory is mistaken. The notion that humans are driven only by self-interest is, in Gowdy's words, a microscopically small minority view among the tens of thousands of cultures that have existed since Homo sapiens emerged some 200,000 years ago. For the vast majority of human generations that have ever lived, it would be unthinkable to hoard food when those around you were hungry. The hunter-gatherer, writes Gowdy, represents uneconomic man. Remember, even those wretched inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego, condemned to the bottom of the scale of human beings, threw down their hoes and walked away from their gardens once the HMS Beagle sailed out of sight. They knew firsthand how civilized people lived, yet they had not the least wish to return to England, Why would they? They were happy and contented with plenty fruits, plenty fish, and plenty birdies. Chapter 13. The never-ending battle over prehistoric war. Brutish?
Evolutionists say that back in the twilight of life, a beast, name and nature unknown, planted a murderous seed, and that the impulse thus originated in that seed throbs forever in the blood of the brute's descendants. William Jennings Bryan.
Just as neo-Hobbesian fundamentalists hold that poverty is intrinsic to the eternal human condition, they maintain that war is fundamental to our nature. Author Nicholas Wade, for example, claims that warfare between pre-state societies was incessant, merciless, and conducted with the general purpose, often achieved, of annihilating the opponent. According to this view, our propensity for organized conflict has roots reaching deep into our biological past, back to distant primate ancestors by way of our foraging forebears. It's always been about making war, supposedly, not love. But nobody's very clear what all this incessant war was over. Despite his certainty that foragers' lives were plagued by constant warfare, Wade acknowledges that ancestral people lived in small egalitarian societies without property or leaders or differences of rank. So we're to understand that egalitarian, non-hierarchical, nomadic groups without property were constantly at war? Hunter-gatherer societies, possessing so little, and thus with so little to lose, other than their lives, living on a wide-open planet, were nothing like the densely populated, settled societies struggling over dwindling or accumulated resources in more recent historical times. Why would they be? We've no space for a comprehensive response to this aspect of the standard Hobbesian narrative, but we've selected three well-known figures associated with it for a closer look at their arguments and data. Evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker, the revered primatologist Jane Goodall, and the world's most famous living anthropologist, Napoleon Chagnon. Professor Pinker, red in tooth and claw. Imagine a high-profile expert stands before a distinguished audience and argues that Asians are warlike people. In support of his argument, he presents statistics from 7 countries: Argentina, Poland, Ireland, Nigeria, Canada, Italy, and Russia. Wait a minute, you might say. Those aren't even Asian countries, except possibly Russia. The expert would be laughed off the stage, as he should be. In 2007, world-famous Harvard professor and best-selling author Steven Pinker gave a presentation built upon similarly flawed logic at the TED conference, Technology Entertainment Design, in Long Beach, California. Pinker's presentation provides both a concise statement of the neo-Hobbesian view of the origins of war and an illuminating look at the dubious rhetorical tactics often used to promote this blood-stained vision of our prehistory. The 29-minute talk is available at the TED website. We encourage you to watch at least the first 5 minutes dealing with prehistory before reading the following discussion. Go ahead. We'll wait here. Though Pinker spends less than 10% of his time discussing hunter-gatherers, a social configuration, you'll recall, that represents well over 95% of our time on the planet, he manages to make a real mess of things. 3.5 minutes into his talk, Pinker presents a chart based on Lawrence Keeley's War Before Civilization, The Myth of the Peaceful Savage. The chart shows the percentage of male deaths due to warfare in a number of foraging or hunting and gathering societies. He explains that the chart shows that hunter-gatherer males were far more likely to die in war than are men living today. But hold on. The 7 cultures listed are the Hivaro, 2 branches of Yanomami, the Mayenga, Dugumdani, Mergen, Huli, and Gabusi. The Hivaro and both Yanomami groups are from the Amazon region, The Murngin are from northern coastal Australia, and the other four are all from the conflict-ridden, densely populated highlands of Papua New Guinea. Are these groups representative of our hunter-gatherer ancestors? Not even close. Only one of the seven societies cited by Pinker, the Murngin, even approaches being an immediate return foraging society, the way Russia is sort of Asian if you ignore most of its population and history. The Murngin had been living with missionaries, guns, and aluminum powerboats for decades by the time the data Pinker cites were collected in 1975, not exactly prehistoric conditions. None of the other societies cited by Pinker are immediate return hunter-gatherers like our ancestors were. They cultivate yams, bananas, or sugarcane in village gardens while raising domesticated pigs, llamas, or chickens. Even beyond the fact that these societies are not remotely representative of our nomadic, immediate-return hunter-gatherer ancestors, there are still further problems with the data Pinker cites. Among the Yanomami, true levels of warfare are subject to passionate debate among anthropologists, as we'll discuss shortly. The Murngin are not typical even of Australian native cultures, representing a bloody exception to the typical Australian Aborigine pattern of little to no intergroup conflict. Nor does Pinker get the Gabusi right. Bruce Nauft, the anthropologist whose research Pinker cites on his chart, says the Gabusi's elevated death rates had nothing to do with warfare. In fact, Nauft reports that warfare is rare among the Gabusi, writing, "Disputes over territory or resources are extremely infrequent and tend to be easily resolved." Despite all this, Pinker stood before his audience and argued with a straight face that his chart depicted a fair estimate of typical hunter-gatherer mortality rates in prehistoric war. This is quite literally unbelievable. But Pinker is not alone in employing such sleight of hand to advance Hobbes's dark view of human prehistory. In fact, this selective presentation of dubious data is disturbingly common in the literature on human bloodlust. In their book Demonic Males, Richard Wrangham and Dale Peterson admit that war is unusual in nature, a startling exception to the normal rule for animals. But because intergroup violence has been documented in both humans and chimps, they argue, a propensity for war must be an ancient human quality going back to our last common ancestor. We are, they warn, the dazed survivors of a continuous 5-million-year habit of lethal aggression. Ouch. But where are the bonobos? In a book of over 250 pages, the word bonobo appears on only 11 of them, and the species is dismissed as offering a less relevant sense of our last common ancestor than the common chimpanzee does, although many primatologists argue the opposite, but at least they mention the bonobo. In 2007, David Livingstone Smith, author of The Most Dangerous Animal, Human Nature and the Origins of War, published an essay exploring the evolutionary argument that war is rooted in our primate past. In his grisly accounts of chimps pummeling one another to a bloody pulp and eating each other alive, Smith repeatedly refers to them as our closest non-human relative. You'd never know from reading his essay that we have an equally close non-human relative. The bonobo was left strangely, if typically, unmentioned. Amid the macho posturing about the brutal implications of chimpanzee violence, doesn't the equally relevant non-warring bonobo rate a mention at least? Why all the yelling about yang with nary a whisper of yin? All darkness and no light may get audiences excited, but it can't illuminate them. The "oops, forgot to mention the bonobo" technique is distressingly common in the literature on the ancient origins of war. But the bonobo's conspicuous absence is notable not just in discussions of war. Look for the missing bonobo wherever someone claims an ancient pedigree for human male violence of any sort. See if you can find the bonobo in this account of the origins of rape from the dark side of man. Men did not invent rape. Instead, they very likely inherited rape behavior from our ape ancestral lineage. Rape is a standard male reproductive strategy and likely has been one for millions of years. male humans, chimpanzees, and orangutans routinely rape females. Wild gorillas violently abduct females to mate with them. Captive gorillas also rape females. Leaving aside the complications of defining rape in non-human species unable to communicate their experiences and motivations, rape, along with infanticide, war, and murder, has never been witnessed among bonobos in several decades of observation. Not in the wild, not in the zoo, never. Doesn't that warrant a footnote even? The mysterious disappearance of Margaret Power. Even apart from doubts raised by bonobos, there are serious questions worth asking about the nature of chimp warfare. In the 1970s, Richard Wrangham was a graduate student studying the relation between food supply and chimp behavior at Jane Goodall's research center in Gombe, Tanzania. In 1991, 5 years before Wrangham and Peterson's Demonic Males came out, Margaret Power published a carefully researched book, The Egalitarians, Human and Chimpanzee, that asked important questions concerning some of Goodall's research on chimpanzees, without, it must be said, ever expressing anything but admiration for Goodall's scientific integrity and intentions. But Power's name and her doubts are nowhere to be found in Demonic Males. Power noticed that data Goodall collected in her first years at Gombe, from 1961 to 1965, painted a different picture of chimpanzee social interaction than the accounts of chimpanzee warfare she and her colleagues published to global acclaim a few years later. Observations from those first 4 years at Gombe had left Goodall with the impression that chimps were far more peaceable than humans. She saw no evidence of war between groups and only sporadic outbreaks of violence between individuals. These initial impressions of overall primate peace mesh with research published 4 decades later, in 2002, by primatologists Robert Sussman and Paul Garber, who conducted a comprehensive review of the scientific literature on social behavior in primates. After reviewing more than 80 studies of how various primates spend their waking hours, they found that, in almost all species across the board, from diurnal lemurs, the most primitive primates, to apes, usually less than 5% of their day is spent in any active social behavior whatsoever. Sussman and Garber found that usually less than 1% of their day is spent fighting or competing, and it's usually much less than 1%. They found cooperative, affiliative behavior like playing and grooming to be 10 to 20 times more common than conflict in all primate species. But Goodall's impression of relative harmony was to change, not coincidentally, argues Power, precisely when she and her students began giving the chimps hundreds of bananas every day to entice them to hang around the camp so they could be observed more easily. In the wild, chimps spread out to search for food individually or in small groups. Because the food is scattered throughout the jungle, competition is unusual. But, as Franz de Waal explains, as soon as humans start providing food, even in the jungle, the peace is quickly disturbed. The mounds of deliciously smelly fruit locked in reinforced concrete boxes, opened only for timed regular feedings, altered the chimps' behavior dramatically. Goodall's assistants had to keep rebuilding the boxes as the frustrated apes found endless ways of prying or smashing them open. Ripe fruit that could not be eaten immediately was a new experience for them, one that left the chimps confused and enraged. Imagine telling a room of unruly three-year-olds on Christmas morning, each with the strength of 4 adult men, that they'll have to wait an unspecified amount of time to open the piles of presents they can see right there under the tree. Recalling this period a few years later, Goodall wrote, "The constant feeding was having a marked effect upon the behavior of the chimps. They were beginning to move about in large groups more often than they had ever done in the old days. They were sleeping near camp and arriving in noisy hordes early in the morning. Worst of all, the adult males were becoming increasingly aggressive. Not only was there a great deal more fighting than ever before, but many of the chimps were hanging around camp for hours and hours every day." Margaret Power's doubts concerning Goodall's provisioning of the chimps have been largely left unaddressed by most primatologists, not just Wrangham. Michael Giglieri, for example, went to study the chimps in Kibali Forest in nearby Uganda, specifically in response to the notion that the intergroup conflict Goodall's team had witnessed might have been due to the distorting effects of those banana boxes. Giglieri writes, "My mission was to find out whether these warlike killings were normal or an artifact of the researchers having provisioned the chimps with food to observe them." But somehow, Margaret Power's name doesn't even appear in the index of Giglieri's book, published 8 years after hers. We lack the space to adequately explore the questions Power raised, or to address subsequent reports of intergroup conflict among some, but not all, unprovisioned chimps in other study areas. While we've got our doubts about the motivations of Pinker and Shagnon, like Margaret Power, we have none about Jane Goodall's intentions or scientific integrity. Still, with all due respect to Goodall, Power's questions deserve consideration by anyone seriously interested in the debate over the possible primate origins of warfare. The Spoils of War. Margaret Power's questions cut to the heart of the matter. Why fight if there's nothing worth fighting over? Before the scientists started provisioning the apes, food appeared throughout the jungle, so the chimps spread out in search of something to eat each day. Chimps often call out to the others when they find a fruiting tree. Mutual aid helps everyone, and feeding in the forest isn't a zero-sum endeavor. But once they learned that there would be a limited amount of easy food available in the same place each day, more and more chimps started arriving in aggressive, noisy hordes and hanging around. Soon after, Goodall and her students began witnessing the now-famous warfare between chimp groups. Perhaps for the first time ever, the chimps had something worth fighting over. A concentrated, reliable, yet limited source of food. Suddenly, they lived in a zero-sum world. Applying this same reasoning to human societies, we're left wondering why immediate return hunter-gatherers would risk their lives to fight wars. Over what exactly? Food? That spread out in the environment. Societies indigenous to areas where food is concentrated by natural conditions, like the periodic salmon runs of the Pacific Northwest of the United States and Canada, tend not to be immediate return hunter-gatherers. We're more likely to find complex, hierarchical societies like the Kwakiutl, discussed later, in such spots. Possessions? Foragers have few possessions of any non-sentimental value. Land? Our ancestors evolved on a planet nearly empty of human beings for the vast majority of our existence as a species. Women? Possibly, but this claim presumes that population growth was important to foragers, and that women were commodities to be fought over and traded like the livestock of pastoralists. It's likely that keeping populations stable was more important to foragers than expanding it. As we've seen, when a group reaches a certain number of people, it tends to split into smaller groups anyway, and there's no inherent advantage in having more people to feed in band-level societies. We've also seen that women and men would have been free to move among different bands in the fission-fusion social system typical of hunter-gatherers, chimps, and bonobos. The causal reverberations between social structure, foraging, horticultural, agrarian, industrial, population density, and the likelihood of war is supported by research conducted by sociologist Patrick Nolan, who found, "Warfare is more likely in advanced horticultural and agrarian societies than it is in hunting and gathering and simple horticultural societies." When he limited his analysis only to hunter-gatherer and agrarian societies, Nolan found that above-average population density was the best predictor of war. This finding is problematic for the argument that human war is a 5-million-year habit, given our ancestors' low population densities until the post-agricultural population explosion began just a few thousand years ago. Recent research looking at changes in mitochondrial DNA confirms that already low prehistoric global human population levels dropped nearly to extinction at several points due to climatological catastrophes probably triggered by volcanic eruptions, asteroid strikes, and sudden changes in ocean currents. As mentioned previously, the entire world population of Homo sapiens may have dropped to just a few thousand individuals as recently as 74,000 years ago, when the massive Toba eruption severely disrupted world climate. But even with much of the northern hemisphere covered in ice, the world was anything but crowded for our distant ancestors. Population demographics have triggered wars in more recent historical times. Ecologist Peter Turchin and anthropologist Andrei Korotayev looked at data from English, Chinese, and Roman history, finding strong statistical correlations between increases in population density and warfare. Their research suggests population growth could account for as much as 90% of the variation between historical periods of war and peace. Early agriculture's stores of harvested grain and herds of placid livestock were like boxes of bananas in the jungle. There was now something worth fighting over. More. More land to cultivate, more women to increase population to work the land, raise armies to defend it, and help with the harvest, more slaves for the hard labor of planting, harvesting, and fighting. Failed crops in one area would lead desperate farmers to raid neighbors who would retaliate, and so on, over and over. Freedom from war is just another word for nothing to lose or gain. But Neo-Hobbesians ignore this rather straightforward analysis and the data supporting it, insisting that war must be an eternal human drive, all too often resorting to desperate rhetorical tactics like Pinker's to defend their view. In the fourth chapter of his book, Six Societies, Challenging the Myth of Primitive Harmony, for example, Robert Edgerton writes, "Social stratification developed in some small-scale societies that lacked not only bureaucracies and priesthoods, but cultivation as well." Okay, but in support of this assertion about social stratification and brutal rule by elites in small-scale societies, he offers 15 pages of vivid descriptions of, in this order, and leaving nothing out, the Kwakiutl Indians of Vancouver Island, a slave-owning, settled, property-accumulating, potlatch-celebrating, complex, hierarchical society. The Aztec Empire, numbering in the millions, with elaborate religious structures, priesthoods, and untold acres of slave-cultivated land, around a capital city larger than any in Europe at the time of first contact, featuring sewage systems and lighted streets at night. The Zulu Empire, again numbering well into the millions, with slavery, intensive agriculture, animal domestication, and continent-wide trade networks, the Asante Empire of present-day Ghana, which Edgerton tells us was incomparably the greatest military power in West Africa. What any of these empires have to do with small-scale societies with no bureaucracies, priesthoods, or cultivation, Edgerton doesn't say. In fact, he doesn't mention a single foraging society for the rest of the chapter. This is like declaring that cats are difficult to train, then offering as evidence German shepherds, beagles, greyhounds, and golden retrievers. In Beyond War, anthropologist Doug Fry rebuts the Neo-Hobbesian view of universal war. "The belief that there has always been war," Fry writes, "does not correspond with the archaeological facts of the matter." Anthropologist Leslie Sponsel agrees, writing, "Lack of archaeological evidence for warfare suggests that it was rare or absent for most of human prehistory." After conducting a comprehensive review of prehistoric skeletal evidence, anthropologist Brian Ferguson concluded that, apart from one particular site in modern-day Sudan, only about a dozen Homo sapiens skeletons 10,000 years or older, out of hundreds of similar antiquity examined to date, show clear indications of interpersonal violence. Ferguson continues, "If warfare were prevalent in early prehistoric times, the abundant materials in the archaeological record would be rich with evidence of warfare. But the signs are not there." Our bullshit detectors go off when scholars point to violent chimps and a few cherry-picked horticultural human societies mislabeled as foragers, claiming these as evidence of ancient tendencies toward warfare. Even more troubling, these scholars often remain mute on the distorting effects on chimps of food provisioning, ever-shrinking habitats under siege from armies of hungry soldiers and poachers, reduced living space, food, and genetic vigor. Equally troubling is their silence on the crucial effects of population demographics and the rise of the agricultural state on the likelihood of human conflict. The Napoleonic invasion, the Yanomami controversy. As the summer of love was winding down and Jane Goodall's first reports of chimpanzee warfare were exploding into public consciousness, Napoleon Chagnon suddenly became the world's most famous living anthropologist with the publication of Yanomamo, the Fierce People. The year 1968 was a good one to come out with a dashing anthropological adventure yarn claiming to prove that warfare is ancient and integral to human nature. The year began with the Velvet Revolution in Prague and the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. Martin Luther King Jr.'s worst dream came true in Memphis, Robert Kennedy was felled on a Los Angeles stage, and blood and chaos ran in the streets of Chicago. Richard Nixon slinked into the White House, Charles Manson and his followers plotted mayhem in the dry hills above Malibu, and the Beatles put the final touches on the White Album. The year ended with three American astronauts, for the first time ever, gazing back upon this fragile blue planet floating in eternal silence, praying for peace. Given all that, perhaps it's not surprising that Chagnon's account of the chronic warfare of the innately violent Yanomami struck a public nerve. Desperate to understand human murderousness, the public lapped up his depictions of the day-to-day brutality of people he described as our contemporary ancestors. Now in its fifth edition, Yanomamo, the Fierce People, is still the all-time bestseller in anthropology, with millions of copies sold to university students alone. Chagnon's books and films have figured prominently in the education of several generations of anthropologists, most of whom accepted his claims to have demonstrated the inherent ferocity of our species. But Chagnon's research should be approached with caution, as he employs a host of dubious techniques. Ferguson found, for example, that Chagnon conflates common murder with war in his statistics, as does Pinker in his discussion of the Gabusi. But more importantly, Chagnon fails to account for the effects of his own disruptive, rather Hemingway-esque presence among the people he studied. According to Patrick Tierney, author of Darkness in El Dorado, the wars that made Chagnon and the Yanomami famous, the ones he wrote about with such relish in The Fierce People, began on November 14, 1964, the same day the anthropologist arrived with his shotguns, outboard motor, and a canoe full of steel goods to give away. Tierney cites Chagnon's own doctoral thesis, showing that in the 13 years prior to his arrival, no Namawai, a large branch of the Yanomami, had been killed in warfare. But during his 13-month residence among them, 10 Yanomami died in a conflict between the Namawai and the Potanawateri, another branch. Kenneth Good, an anthropologist who first went to live with the Yanomami as one of Chagnon's graduate students and stayed on for 12 years, described Chagnon as a hit-and-run anthropologist who comes into villages with armloads of machetes to purchase cooperation for his research. Unfortunately, wrote Good, he creates conflict and division wherever he goes. Part of Chagnon's disruptiveness, no doubt, resulted from his blustery, macho self-conception, but his research goals may have been an even bigger source of problems. He wanted to collect genealogical information from the Yanomami. This is a tricky proposition, to say the least, given that the Yanomami consider it disrespectful to speak names out loud. Naming the dead requires breaking one of the strongest taboos in their culture. Juan Finkers, who lived among them for 25 years, says, "To name the dead among the Yanomami is a grave insult, a motive of division, fights, and wars." Anthropologist Marshall Solins described Chagnon's research as an absurdist anthropological project, trying to work out ancestor-based lineages among a people who, by taboo, could not know, could not trace, and could not name their ancestors, or for that matter, could not bear to hear their own names. Shagnan dealt with his host's taboo by playing one village off against another. In his own account, he began taking advantage of local arguments and animosities in selecting my informants, traveling to other villages to check the genealogies, picking villages that were on strained terms with the people about whom I wanted information. I would then return to my base camp and check with local informants the accuracy of the new information. If the informants became angry when I mentioned the names I acquired from the unfriendly group, I was almost certain that the information was accurate. I occasionally hit a name that put the informant into a rage, such as that of a dead brother or sister that other informants had not reported. To recap, 1. Our hero swashbuckles into Yanomami lands, bringing machetes, axes, and shotguns he presents to a few select groups, thereby creating disruptive power imbalances between groups. 2. He detects and aggravates pre-existing tensions between communities by goading them to disrespect each other's honored ancestors and dead loved ones. 3. Inflaming the situation further, Shagnan reports the offenses he's provoked, using the resulting rage to confirm the validity of his genealogical data. 4. Having thus inflicted and salted the Yanomami's wounds, Shagnan sallies forth to seduce the American public with tales of daring do among the vicious and violent savages. The word anthro has entered the vocabulary of the Yanomami. It signifies a powerful non-human with deeply disturbed tendencies and wild eccentricities. Since 1995, Shagnan has been legally barred from returning to the lands of the Yanomami. When anthropologist Leslie Sponsel lived among the Yanomami in the mid-1970s, he saw no warfare, just one physical fight, and heard a few loud marital disputes. "To my surprise," writes Sponsel, "people in my village and three neighboring villages were simply nothing like the fierce people described by Shagnan." Sponsel had brought along a copy of Shagnan's book, with its photos of fighting Yanomami warriors, as a way to explain the sort of work he was doing. "Although some of the men were absorbed by the pictures," he writes, "I was asked not to show them to children, as they provided examples of undesirable behavior. These Yanomami," Sponsel concluded, "did not value fierceness in any positive way." For his part, in over a decade living among them, Good witnessed a single outbreak of war. He cut his association with Shagnan eventually, having concluded the emphasis on Yanomami violence was contrived and distorted. Good later wrote that Shagnan's book had blown the subject out of any sane proportion, arguing that what he had done was tantamount to saying that New Yorkers are muggers and murderers. The desperate search for hippie hypocrisy and bonobo brutality. For a certain kind of journalist or evolutionary psychologist, nothing is more satisfying than exposing hippie hypocrisy. A recent headline from Reuters reads, "Hippie apes make war as well as love," study finds. The article states, "Despite their reputation as lovers, not fighters, of the primate world, bonobos actually hunt and kill monkeys." Another assures us that, "Despite peacenik reputation, bonobos hunt and eat other primates, too." A third, under the heading, "Sex-crazed apes feast on killing, too," opens with an audible sneer. "As hippies had Altamont, where Hell's Angels killed a concertgoer, so bonobos have Salonga National Park, where scientists have witnessed the supposedly peace-loving primate hunting and eating monkey children." Sex-crazed? Supposedly peace-loving? Eating monkey children? Do monkeys have children? If both chimps and bonobos make war, maybe we are dazed survivors of a 5-million-year habit of lethal aggression after all. But a closer look reveals that it's the journalists who are a bit dazed. Researchers witnessed 10 attempts to hunt monkeys over 5 years of observing the bonobos in question. The bonobos were successful 3 times, sharing the monkey meat among the hunters, mixed groups of males and females. A brief reality check for science journalists. Researchers have long known and reported that bonobos regularly hunt and eat meat, generally small jungle antelopes, known as duikers, as well as squirrels, insects, and grubs. The evolutionary line leading to humans, chimps, and bonobos split from that leading to monkeys about 30 million years ago. Chimps and bonobos, in other words, are as closely related to monkeys as we are. Young monkeys are not children. Monkey meat is on the menu at fancy Chinese restaurants and jungle barbecues in many parts of the world. Tens of thousands of monkeys, young and old, are sacrificed in research laboratories throughout the world annually. So, are humans also at war with monkeys? Nothing sells newspapers like headlines of war, and no doubt cannibalistic hippie orgy war sells even more. But one species hunting and eating another species is hardly war, it's lunch. That bonobos and monkeys may look similar to untrained eyes is irrelevant. When a pack of wolves or coyotes attacks a stray dog, is that war? We've seen hawks pluck pigeons out of the sky. War? Asking whether our species is naturally peaceful or warlike, generous or possessive, free-loving or jealous, is like asking whether H2O is naturally a solid liquid or gas. The only meaningful answer to such a question is, it depends. On a nearly empty planet, with food and shelter distributed widely, avoiding conflict would have been an easy, attractive option. Under the conditions typical of ancestral environments, human beings would have had much more to lose than to gain from warring against one another. The evidence, both physical and circumstantial, points to a human prehistory in which our ancestors made far more love than war. Chapter 14. The Longevity Lie. Short.
The days of our years are 80 years and 10. And if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow. For it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Psalms 90, verse 10.
Strange but true, the average height expectancy of prehistoric humans was about 3 feet, so a 4-foot-tall man was considered a giant. Does that fact alter your image of prehistory? Are you picturing a diminutive race of bonsai people living in mini caves, chasing rabbits into holes, cowering in fear of foxes, being carried off by hawks? Does this cause you to rethink what a challenge a mammoth hunt must have been for our half-pint ancestors? Does it make you feel even luckier to be living today, when our superior diet and sanitation have doubled the average person's height expectancy? Well, don't get carried away. While it is technically true that the average height expectancy of prehistoric men was about 3 feet, it's a misleading sort of truth. Like overconfident declarations about the universality of marriage, poverty, and war, it's the sort of assertion that sows confusion and results in a harvest of misleading data. Take the average height of a full-grown man living in prehistoric times, using skeletal remains as a guide, about 6 feet tall, 72 inches. Then take the average size of a prehistoric infant skeleton, let's say about 20 inches. Then extrapolate from the ratio of infant to adult skeletons at known archaeological burial sites and presume that in general, for every 3 people who lived to adulthood, 7 died as infants. Thus, owing to the high rate of infant mortality, average human height in prehistory was 3 times 72 plus 7 times 20 divided by 10 equals 35.6 inches, roughly 3 feet. Absurd? Yes. Misleading? Yep. Statistically accurate? Well, kinda. This height expectancy truth is no more absurd or misleading than what most people are led to believe about human life expectancy in prehistory. Exhibit A.